When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi there, this is Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, and your host on It Happened in Hollywood. This week, we have the writer-director of Disney's 1985 sequel to The Wizard of Oz. All that and more on It Happened in Hollywood.
Summer, Walt Disney Pictures presents a motion picture fantasy adventure beyond your fondest imagination. You'll be transported miraculously back to the enchanted land of Oz, that magical kingdom beloved by young and old for generations.
It's just a yellow brick.
No, Belina, you don't understand. This was the Yellow Brick Road.
You share with Dorothy Gale the shock of finding everything mysteriously changed.
What's happened to everybody?
Hi, and welcome back. The name Walter Murch might not be familiar with you, but you're definitely familiar with his work. He went to USC way back with George Lucas and became part of a group of filmmakers that changed Hollywood forever. They include Francis Ford Coppola, and he actually innovated all the sound in Coppola's films and won an Oscar for Apocalypse Now. But then he eventually went on to make his own film. It would be the only film he ever made. He chose to make a sequel to The Wizard of Oz, and it was 1985's Return to Oz, made for a big budget at Disney with a lot of the same creative folk who made Star Wars. The film was poorly received both by audiences and critics, who felt it was way too dark and not in keeping with the original Wizard of Oz. But over the years, people have found that it's actually quite a brilliant piece of work, and I'm amongst them. Walter Murch created something very special with Return to Oz, and yes, it is dark, but it also has a lot of things to say about childhood. And of course, it introduced Firouzza Balk at 9 years old as a very different take, but probably truer to the books, on Dorothy Gale. Anyway, enough chit-chat, let's get right into the talk. Here is Walter Murch and Return to Oz. Walter Murch, welcome to It Happened in Hollywood. It's a real honor to have you here.
Thank you.
You have an incredible, storied, many decades long career in Hollywood, and it begins at USC with one of the most famous filmmakers of all time. Would you say so, George Lucas?
Yes, absolutely. I met George at USC. He'd already been there a year, and I came in as a graduate student from Johns Hopkins University. And my first memory of him was a shadowy figure behind me in the photography developing room. And I was trying unsuccessfully to develop one of the photographs that I had taken for an exercise. And there was this voice behind me that said, "You're doing it wrong." I turned around and I said, "Who is this guy?" Of course, it turned out he was right. I was doing it wrong. But our friendship started off on that foot.
And so you went on to work on his first movie, THX-1138.
That's his first feature, yeah. But he and I had worked together on film school in many of his films. I worked on at film school. And then we all moved up to the Bay Area and with American, the founding of American Zoetrope, to create a professional film studio, but based on our experiences at film school. This was with Francis Coppola, and THX was the first film out of the gate. And he and I wrote the screenplay for it, and I did the soundtrack on it.
So your specialty was, from early on, sound, right?
Yeah. I had fallen in love with sound recording when I was a teenager. And so when I went to film school, I gravitated towards sound because that was what I knew. And I spilled over from that into film editing, very similar process to sound editing. And that's been my specialties ever since.
And you have first credited sound design, is that correct?
That's right, on Apocalypse Now. This was the first film mixed in what we now call 5.1. We created that up here in San Francisco because Francis wanted the film to sound like no other film had sounded yet. And so we designed 5.1 along with Dolby Sound here, also based in San Francisco. And when Francis said, well, what do you want as a credit? Because I was a film editor, picture editor on Apocalypse. And I also was the re-recording mixer on the film, the lead mixer. But I had also designed, I guess, what you would call, how would we approach using this new sound format? So I thought, well, production design takes a three-dimensional space and decorates it with various objects, furniture, paintings on the wall, etc. And I've been given the three-dimensional space of the theater, because that's what 5.1 gives you. So, and I'm decorating it with sound. So if they can call themselves production designers, I'll call myself a sound designer. So that's how it came about.
Amazing. And now that's a common credit, right?
Yeah, it split. It's a contentious credit, especially at the beginning. It's been used occasionally by people to say, I created a new sound by combining various other sounds. So I designed this sound, you know, a new kind of a gunshot or a new kind of a punch. And so that's sound design. I was using it in a different way, much more kind of architectural term.
I mean, if you had done just that, what an amazing contribution to cinematic history. And you went on to do not just Apocalypse Now, you did the Godfather films, you did The Conversation, you did Coppola's best work. You were right there with him creating the sound.
And editing the picture, too.
Did you edit all of those, or which of those did you?
I edited the picture on The Conversation and on Apocalypse Now.
Wow, holy cow. And you won Oscars as well, didn't you?
Won an Oscar for Best Sound on Apocalypse, yeah. And then Best Sound and Best Film Editing on English Patient later.
I have to ask, were you one of the lucky 300 who were invited to see Megalopolis, the first screening of Francis's new movie?
No, I wasn't there.
I have to say, I'm very curious to see that one.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, well, then your bona fides are pretty good, but we're going to take it into a slightly different direction today, because what I want to talk about is the one film that you've directed, favorite of mine, just for its originality and strangeness and bravery, I really think, which is The Return to Oz from 1985. I believe your path to that film came not from your editing, but from your writing. Is that correct?
Well, yes, I was co-author of the screenplay with Gil Dennis. And then I directed the film. And Disney in the late 70s, early 80s was in a quandary. The Walt Disney had died a decade or so earlier. And there had been many of his projects in the pipeline. But then once those had been made, they were wondering, what happens now? What would Walt do? That was a common phrase, apparently, at the time. And there were two films from San Francisco that shocked them. One was Star Wars, and the other one was The Black Stallion. And Star Wars, obviously, written and directed by George Lucas. Black Stallion, directed by Carol Ballard. I was one of the authors of the early drafts of the screenplay. And so they thought, well, let's contact Walter, you know. I think they were reaching out to people outside of their comfort zone, because up until that point, Disney Studios had been very closed, and they realized they were running out of creative oxygen, I guess you could say. So I went down to talk to Tom Wilhite, one of the executives there, and he said, after some usual pleasantries, well, what are you interested in that you think we would be interested in? What's our common ground? And I had thought a little bit about this in advance, obviously, and I said a sequel to The Wizard of Oz. And he jumped back a little bit and shuffled some papers on his desk and said, well, you know, we own the rights to all of those films, don't you? And I said, no, I didn't know. So things took off from there. They were very interested in developing them because they owned the rights, which were going to run out, I think, within the next 5 or 6 years. And so Gil and I put together a treatment. They approved the treatment. We wrote a screenplay, went through several drafts, and then eventually we went into pre-production.
Now Wizard of Oz is public domain, right? Anyone who wants to can make a Wizard of Oz movie with Dorothy and the whole crew. And they are doing that with Wicked is coming out, and they've done other versions. But at this point, Disney owned Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is, you know, first of all, the chutzpah to say, well, I'm going to make a sequel to The Wizard of Oz, the most beloved children's film of all time, or film period of all time. But what was interesting is that you didn't let that intimidate you, and you didn't try to mimic what that film did. You seem to go more to the source material and stay real to that.
Yeah, I had grown up with the Oz books. My mother was a big devotee of those books from when she was a child. So when I was ready for them, age 3 or 4 or 5, whatever, she started reading them to me, and then I started reading them myself. In fact, the books on which Return to Oz are based are the first, let's say, real books that I remember reading as a kid, meaning books that had more text than pictures in them. And so my imaginative life was really formed by the books by L. Frank Baum, the author of all of that whole series. And in those days, especially in my mother's day, they were, you know, tremendously important books to kids. There was one new book every year. So I only saw The Wizard of Oz very late in life, meaning like 12 years old. But by then, my imagination was already in place, and I didn't really accept what they had done in 1939. It didn't jive with what my vision of Oz was about. So that's the film. You know, I tried to make the film more like the books, more faithfully to the books, mainly in making Dorothy 9 years old rather than 15 or 16, or however old Judy Garland was at the time.
And speaking of Dorothy, so you discovered a young actress, Fairuza Balk, who is extraordinary in the movie, I would say.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
How did you find her? She went on to other greater things, but how did you find her?
We cast a wide net over the United States and Canada. I think we interviewed 1,200 girls of that age. And, you know, it's a filtering process. 1,200 becomes 250. 250 becomes 60, 60 becomes 12, 12 becomes 2, and then finally we cast Fairuza. The final two were brought to London. The sets were already being constructed, the costumes, the creatures, so we were able to rehearse those two girls in costume with the other characters and situations, and Fairuza shone very brightly. She was very much at ease in that environment. In between takes, we'd look around in the darkness of the stage. What happened to Rosa? And then we heard laughter coming from way up toward the ceiling of the stage. And she had, on her own, climbed up the scaffolding and was just treating it like a giant jungle gym. She loved the whole process. She loved the people involved. As a 9-year-old, it was a great field day for her own imaginative works, and she would improvise her own performance, you know, and so she was already internalizing Dorothy. She wasn't simply following the screenplay. She was developing that inner source of what all great actors do.
She brings a certain weight to it. There's a darkness at the beginning, of course, when she's, well, what sets the action is that she can't sleep from her adventures from the original Wizard of Oz. And so her guardian, cherished Auntie M, takes her to some doctor for electroshock therapy. It's quite a dark opening.
Hannah, it's been 6 months since the tornado, and Dorothy hasn't been herself since. I'm taking her to Cottonwood Falls tomorrow to see if she can be helped. All she ever talks about is some place that just doesn't exist. Talking tin men, walking scarecrows, ruby slippers.
Yeah, technically, it's electrotherapy. Shock therapy came along in the 30s. But the idea was that when you have nightmares and you can't sleep, your brain has gotten tangled, like tangled hair. And so they induce this electrical signal that, in essence, combs through the tangled neurons of your brain. This was early stuff. I mean, it was only 25 years earlier that we had discovered that the brain was an electrical thing. So it was early stuff.
There was a sequence in that, or a scene in that sequence where the doctor brings in the machine and he says, right, the machine has a face, and he points out. Now, first of all, is that machine a historical real thing, or did you have that built?
It is the real deal.
That's what I sensed.
When I was writing the screenplay, thinking, how are we going to get into this story? On a totally separate mission, I went to an antique store, a Goodwill store, looking for a dresser for my eldest daughter, because she was moving out into her own space. And I got this strange feeling coming from the corner of the store. And what is that over there? And I went over, and there was that machine, that very machine. And I asked the owner of the store, what is this thing? Well, it's an electrotherapy machine. The father of the man who just died, it was an estate sale. How much is it? $125 or something. Well, I put down $25, and then I forgot about it, strangely to say. And my wife bumped into somebody who had seen it at the store with merch written on it. And so she bought it for my birthday. And then I put it up on the wall here in this space, my office. And after, I was working on the screenplay and I began to get this strange feeling again. And I looked at the machine, and that's when I saw the face in it. And then that's where I made the connection between that machine and the character of TikTok.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so none of the electric stuff is in the books. That was all out of this random thrift store find.
Right, exactly.
Incredible. Yeah, well, it has a face and it looked very authentic. It didn't look like it was made in a prop room. So then, of course, there's a flood. And this time we don't have a tornado, we have a flood. A shockingly real-looking flood where she gets swept away down a rushing river.
It's all fake. Yeah, I mean, it's not fake. It's real water. And there's no digital stuff anywhere in the film. But it was constructed on a stage. It was basically a big swimming pool with pumps at one end and suction at the other. The water was heated, so the girls didn't freeze. And a mini set of a forest was built. This is all Norman Reynolds, who was the production designer on Star Wars and other films like that. And it was real, but, cinematic trickery.
Speaking of Star Wars, didn't you share a few of the production people from Star Wars?
Yeah, and also from The Muppets, Jim Henson. It was all of the creature design and everything. Many of those were by people who were kind of freelancing from their usual job working for Jim Henson.
So let's talk about some of those creatures. We'll start with TikTok, since you've already brought him up. These days, TikTok has a very different connotation, but
I know, amazing. Yeah,
in this he's a wind-up robot. I'm busy looking for the seams or if it's stop motion, but that's all happening live in the camera eye, right?
Yeah, everything is live in this film, or three-dimensional reality, let's say. Michael Sundin, who was the British trampoline champion, he had a very low center of gravity. I think he was about 5'3", something like that. And he was an acrobat dancer, and he was able to contort himself inside the body of TikTok. It meant that he had to bend over backwards and cross his arms left and right and look at a tiny video screen that we had placed inside TikTok. And there was a camera broadcasting that image to him, showing him where he was in space. So a completely mind-boggling but successful way of creating this character. His head was being controlled by radio control totally separately to what he was doing. So the eye blinks, the mustache movement, and the turning of the head was a separate control. And those two entities had to coordinate with each other.
Well, I mean, it's an unbelievable illusion. It was completely flawless, and you feel for him. You get all the emotion you want out of him. It's so beautifully done, and I really can still not imagine how a person was in there, but I love the character of TikTok.
He had a limit of 2.5 minutes. You know, as soon as he was clamped in, a stopwatch was started, and whatever we were doing with him had to be finished 2.5 minutes later. Otherwise, he would kind of begin to suffocate in there.
That's not very long. You really had to be on your game.
Yep.
Okay, let's keep going through the characters. Jack Pumpkinhead. What occurred to me is one, Jack Skellington from The Nightmare Before Christmas is very similar to this character, at least in how he looks and his skinniness of his whole body, except for the big pumpkin head. Right. I wonder if that's an inspiration of theirs.
I think so. You know, I mean, Jack Pumpkinhead existed in the books, but I haven't connected up the dots to know absolutely that there was a connection, but there kind of must have been.
And so he was performed by Brian Henson?
Brian was one of the three puppeteers that managed Jack, and Brian also supplied the voice.
So Jack, there was no person in that one? That was a full puppet?
Very occasionally, for long shots where we couldn't hide the wires that controlled him, we did have a person in a Jack costume, a very, very thin, tall person.
Again, amazing illusion. And I think that's why the film is so successful, is that you've created a fantasy that is fully believable.
Well, I hope so.
And then, of course, I love the chicken, Belina.
Yep.
Which is a sort of photorealistic chicken, but and is in Kansas with Dorothy, but then she makes the journey back to Oz and suddenly she can just talk.
Yeah, she was a puppet operated by Mac Wilson, one of the Henson puppeteers. But she was also, again, like Jack, occasionally she is a real chicken, depending on what she had to do. If she has to fly through the air, that was more than a Belina puppet could do. So, you know, whenever Belina is in a medium shot or a close shot, that's likely to be a puppet. And if she's flying through the air or attacking Mombi the witch, that's a real chicken. I should say the animal trainer on the film who was responsible for the chicken, I said, okay, here's what the chicken has to do. And I listed all of the things and he was completely nonplussed by this. Oh yeah, that's fine. I can do that. I have specialty chickens who can be relied upon to do each of the tricks that they have to do. And he said, are there any other animals? And I said, well, there's Toto the dog. Well, what does Toto have to do? I thought, well, he just has to be there, but he has to howl. And he dropped his pencil at that point. Mike Cullen, his name. And this is the guy who did the snakes in Indiana Jones. So he was used to really strange stuff. And he said, terriers don't howl because Toto is a terrier dog. And so I got a lecture on the difference between terriers and wolf-based dogs. And wolf dogs howl, but terriers don't. I was immediately depressed by this, thinking, she has to howl. And we were visiting some friends in London, friends of my wife, and an ambulance went by. And after the ambulance went by, I heard howling coming from the basement. And I said, what's that? Oh, that's Tansy, our dog. She always howls, so I ran downstairs into the basement, and there was a terrier howling, so I howled at her, and she howled back, and I said, you're going to be a star, and that's the Toto dog in the film.
So was Toto recast, or you hadn't cast Toto yet?
No, we hadn't. We were looking, you know, we were dealing with this fact that terriers don't howl, and so I brought Tansy in, and she howled, and Mike, the animal trainer, fell in love, and she was used for many years after. He loved her and used her in commercials and all kinds of things. So,
well, that is a fantastic story. Thank you for sharing that story. Sure. That's incredible. And then, of course, the villains are certainly terrifying. And, you know, people say, oh, this movie is so terrifying, and how could you make it so terrifying? But the original Wizard of Oz was quite terrifying, too, especially the Wicked Witch.
Yeah, I remember talking to Maurice Sendak, the children's author, Where the Wild Things Are, and he said he went to see the original Wizard of Oz when he was 6 or 7 and came out completely traumatized by it. So, you know, we tend to forget, because it's so familiar now, what an impact the original film had.
Sure. But this one has two quite scary villains that I'd love to just touch on, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One is this sort of Nurse Ratchet character at the beginning, Nurse Wilson, right, who is going to put the electrodes on poor Dorothy when she's strapped down to a gurney. And then later she becomes the witch, Mombi.
Right.
Who, in one of the most unforgettable sequences, she has kind of a whole showroom of heads to choose from. I assume women she's decapitated over the years, and she just uses the heads herself.
Right.
Now, that's dark stuff.
This is in the book. You know, this is a cabinet of heads, 30 heads that she has. Like, you know, like women have a closet full of hats, here she has heads. And each of the heads presumably has a slightly different personality. So when you first meet Mombi, she's a little kind of an airhead, kind of a vague person, sort of self-conceited. And then she goes into the cabinet room and in front of Dorothy switches heads from this airhead to a much more commanding presence, intense, who decides that Dorothy should provide a new head when she's grown up.
You will be rather attractive. One day. Not at all beautiful, you understand, but you'll have a certain prettiness. Different from my other heads. I believe I'll lock you in the tower for a few years till your head is ready. And then I'll take it.
I should say, in Oz, nothing ever dies. There are no fatal wounds in the Land of Oz. That's one of the rules of the road of this fantasy world. So, yeah, it's one thing to read about it and to see a still illustration of it, which you see in the books. It's another thing to actually see it and see it from the point of view of a 9-year-old girl. And, you know, that does add an extra shiver factor to it.
Yes, definitely shades of the Queen of Hearts, off with her head in that. Yes. And also another Henson children's movie that was way scarier than it should have been, The Witches, and uh-huh. The transformation scene of Angelica Houston when she pulls off her mask, and that level of terror.
Well, fairy tales are frightening things.
Absolutely.
I wanted the film to be frightening in places, in the sense of the Grimm's fairy tales, but it has a happy ending at the end of it. When the film came out, I was not prepared for how frightening audiences felt that it'd become, which I think had to do with the expectations that people brought in to the film, thinking that it was going to be rainbows and lollipops and that kind of stuff. But it's a different film.
Not a munchkin in sight.
Right, we have the Wheelers instead.
Right, and the Wheelers are very scary as well. They're these half-man, half-motorcycle hybrid creatures, but they're also kind of crazy, quite threatening, but very effective. Who designed that?
Norman Reynolds designed them. Yeah.
Yeah, beautifully done.
We had to find people who were capable of doing that, you know, long-term. It was similar, not quite as intense as Michael Sundin inside TikTok, but it was still a difficult thing initially for them to figure out how to do it. After a while, they were very comfortable with it. And even in between takes, they wouldn't take off the wheels. They just kind of pirouetted around, lounged around, and they also got fully into character.
That was sort of your answer to the flying monkeys. You had wheelers.
Yeah.
who did the witch's bidding.
Yep.
Now, I know halfway through production, Disney started to get cold feet. Can you walk us through what happened with that and how you almost lost your job?
Cold feet is not exactly how to describe it. They fired me 5 weeks into a 16-week schedule. And we had not yet really shot any of the Oz material. Everything we shot was everything that happens in Kansas. We were just beginning to find our footing in the fantasy world. And I had lost my first assistant director. Paul Maslansky, the producer, fired him and hired somebody else. And then I lost Freddie Francis, the DP, and he was replaced by David Watkin. So there was a lot of turbulence because, well, the normal filmmaking stuff, but intensified because there were probably people at Disney who were looking at the daily saying, what is this? And we were falling behind, partly because of my inexperience. This is the first feature film I'd ever directed, so I take responsibility for that. Also, Freddie Francis, very talented cinematographer, but his approach was, show me the shot and I will light the shot. So once I'd selected a lens and a camera position for a shot, then the lights would come and every shot was lit by multiple sources of light. And what that did was inhibit what a B camera could do, because you had to be on the same axis as the A camera. And that also limited the usefulness of whatever we were shooting. When David Watkin came in, he had a completely different approach. He knew and respected Freddie, but he said, I'm completely different. I won't even be on the set while you shoot. What I do is I pre-light the set. You can put the camera anywhere you want. You can shoot with however many cameras you want. Everything will look great because of how I light. And just let Gordon, the A camera operator, you know, talk to him about any problems. If there's a real problem, then Gordon will come and fetch me from the next set that I'm pre-lighting and we'll solve whatever. But I think that happened only once in the whole thing. So we were just beginning to, in a sense, unclench from a situation where we could now use two or three cameras at the same time. Even with all the puppets, you know, you can imagine how difficult it is, because if you hide the puppeteers from one camera angle, it may not be the same from another camera angle. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we were working all of that stuff out, and we were actually shooting the Cabinet of Heads scene, and the head of Disney, Richard Berger, flew over from Los Angeles, had a conference with Paul Maslansky, and they decided that I was going to be yanked for, as they put it, for the good of the film and for your good as well. They were concerned. They thought about my health.
Always thinking the other person, Hollywood.
So I was fired. Word got out that this had happened. Robert Watts, one of George's producers for the Indiana Jones films, telephoned George in Japan. George was working with Kurosawa on something and flew the next day, I think, from Japan to London, met with Richard Berger, and negotiations started. George thought it was crazy to fire me. Nobody would ever pick it up again, the film. You'd have to shut down the whole film. And the clincher was that George said he would talk to me about what the problems were, and if the problems continued, get Walter back shooting again. A week after I was fired, I was rehired again. Although during all that time, shooting had continued in order to keep the momentum going. And Mike Kitchens, the associate producer, was directing in my stead. You know, the whole film had been storyboarded, so things could continue. And Mike and I were talking by telephone every day about what was happening. So as you can imagine, it was a very fraught time.
But how nice that George Lucas really stood up for you at that moment and flew in from Japan. I mean, he must really believe in you for good reason to put his name on the line like that. That's incredible.
Absolutely.
And the film did finish. Did you finish on time and within budget?
Yeah. Once the gears meshed again, we finished on time. You know, we had lost money because of the whole idea of the film early on was to be a globe-trotting film like Indiana Jones. And we were going to shoot in Algeria, Sardinia, Kansas, London, you know, basically like Indiana Jones. And when Richard Berger took over from Disney in October of 83, he basically said, that's not going to happen. So all of the money that we had spent in that kind of prep was lost. But other than that, once we got back on track again, we did finish on time.
I was going to ask who was heading the company. So this was not the Michael Eisner Katzenberg era yet?
The Return to Oz went through three different administrations. It was greenlit by the Miller-Wilhite team. Once we were very close to shooting, they were gone. Miller went upstairs to some executive position, and that's when Richard Berger took control. And he was the studio head all during shooting and during some of the editing. And then in October or September of 84, he was out and Michael Eisner and Katzenberg came in. So, you know, we were just like Dorothy has aunt and uncles, you know, whatever happened to her parents, the film itself was kind of like a foster child that was passed from one set of executives to another.
I'm curious, what did Eisner and Katzenberg make of the dailies and what was going on set?
You know, I think they had their own agenda, and this was a film that was greenlit two generations ago. And so they, you know, we had conversations, but they were pretty much hands off. You know, I finished the film without any studio interference, which in retrospect was kind of ominous because they were definitely not interested in fine-tuning the marketing of this film to prepare the audience for a different kind of Oz. They just wanted to tap into whatever residual favor that the 1939 film had, and which I think was one of the main problems in the reception that the film received.
Right. It wasn't just children who were scared. It was critics were, you know, what is this? This isn't what Oz should be, and it's too dark. Yeah. And everyone pushed against what your vision.
Yeah, well, the very first review that came out was Mike Clark in USA Today, and he gave it 3 out of 4 stars, and he liked the film. And so I thought, okay, we're on our way. And then the hammer fell with Siskel and Ebert, who really didn't like the film. They wanted lollipops and rainbows. And they didn't only dismiss the film, they kind of buried it and then danced on its grave with a long program of, this is how the film should have been made. And they showed clips of the original film and clips of The Wiz. And so that was the beginning of the brutalization by critics of the film.
That must be so hard to experience on your first film that you've struggled to get to pass the finish line and did.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tale oft told. You know, that's the world that we filmmakers live in. You have to, you know, be prepared for the knocks and take them when they come.
Did George Lucas or Francis give their feedback to you?
No, just kind of well done. You know, there was no long post-mortem on the film.
Well, I think with time, though, it has found its appreciators, and I'm among them. I think it's actually a work of genius.
Well, thank you.
Sometimes it takes longer for people to realize something like that. But I know that it has its fans out there now.
Yeah, you know, it's out on, there's a Blu-ray of it that exists. The Disney Channel, I think, has it. And you can get it on Amazon. It's got a high rating on Amazon, 4.8 or something. So it's, it found its channel. In retrospect, hoped that it would have found its channel earlier. But as I said, those are the breaks. And I was not naive about the challenge of making a sequel to The Wizard of Oz. And my strategy, which did not work, was to make it as different as possible. Because I knew I wasn't temperamentally equipped, nor was the film culture equipped to recreate a musical circa 1939 in 1984. So I tried to push it in another direction, which is, you know, basically saying, okay, at the end of the first film, Dorothy says, oh, there's no place like home. I'm so glad to see you all again. But what happens the next day? You know, does she forget about that whole experience, or does it come back? And if it comes back, the people around her don't accept it. So what does she do? And it's out of that situation, in addition to the problems of a farm that's been devastated by a tornado, trying to rebuild it. You know, I was interested in the reality of what farm life was like 125 years ago and building it up from that foundation.
Yeah, there's so many touches in it that I just really respond to. One is the casting of Piper Laurie as Annie M,
yeah,
who's, you know, famous for being the mother in Carrie, and that relationship with a teenage girl or a young girl, you know, and then she, of course, doesn't quite protect her enough. She sends her to this facility. And, you know, when you say that fairy tales are dark things, I think ultimately they connect psychologically to humans in a very fundamental, nightmarish or dreamlike ways, aspiration. And that's why the film is so successful. It doesn't feel like a product. It feels like you really tapped into something real. And that's why it's a lasting film to me.
Yeah. I mean, the Aunt M problem is that she has a husband who has a broken leg. She goes to the local town, which has electricity. And, you know, it's the beginning of the modern age. And these people live and work in, you know, a highly professional, seemingly caring environment. And she has to get back to Uncle Henry, back on the farm before nightfall. And, you know, she has other things concerning her than, another kind of film would have all of those things happen, and then Aunt Em would be riding away, and then she'd stop the carriage and say, "By gum, I think there's something funny going on there," and she would go back to the clinic to pull Dorothy out, and then other things would happen, but she doesn't. And it turns out that the people at the clinic have their own agenda. And, you know, it's the kind of the hidden message here is, kids, you've got to rely, sometimes you have to rely on your own self, your inner being, and the friends that you make in the most unlikely places, like TikTok, Belina, Jack, and the Gump. And that grown-ups are not always acting in your best interest. Even sometimes, though, they think they are acting, and by certain lights, they are acting in your best interest, but it might not turn out to be so. So you have to develop an inner core. And, you know, that is one of the themes of the film and the reason for Dorothy defending her experience in Oz, that she's not willing to simply knuckle under and say, no, that never happened, I was crazy. And she, in a sense, she reestablishes Oz within herself by the end of the film against the forces, which are all grown-ups trying to do things to her.
I mean, it's a very true sentiment, that theme, but also one that I could see going against everything Walt Disney Corporation believes in.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, the whole Disneyland world is kind of a recreation, especially at the beginning, of the gay 90s of 1890, 1900, you know, slightly before Walt himself was born, but Disney romanticized that period. But in actuality, that period was very good for a few very rich people, kind of like the problem we have today, and ordinary people like farmers, like Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, had it very tough. There was a depression all throughout the middle of 1890s. And that's another thing that the film taps into. There's a conflict, I admit, I'm guilty of it, but that was one of the things I hoped would set the film apart. Of course, at the time, it set it so far apart that audiences had a hard time with it.
Hmm.
They wanted the illusion, and I was running against that.
You were just too real for them, Walter. Anyway, in my mind, you've created a lasting classic. And if anyone out there has not seen it, it's on Disney Plus. Please go see Return to Oz. It really is a very special, very strange, and yes, scary film, but really satisfying artistically. So thank you so much, Walter, for joining us. It means a lot to me.
Thank you very much. Very, very good questions.
Well, thank you once again, Walter Murch. It was a real honor to get to meet you and speak to you. Your contribution to cinematic history, whether it be in The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, and the incredible Return to Oz, will live on forever. That's all for this week. We'll see you next time. And until then, we'll see you in Hollywood.